You are correct, Paula. Thank you so much for pausing because I hate to put the music on top of your voice. Welcome to episode 85, everyone. You're going to get the last minute of Paula's compliance training this morning, even if you didn't dial in early.
Yeah, I knew that it was coming. I looked at my clock and I was like, oh, she's about to cut me off. So anyway, if you find yourself in a precarious situation in your own organization, like we were talking about in the pre-show, depending on the size of your organization and your position, you may need to consider contacting your compliance officer. And I'd say you do need to consider contacting your compliance officer and possibly even conferring with an attorney and or reviewing your vendor contracts before determining how to proceed. So maintaining compliance is imperative. And remember, the compliance program elements we spoke about are minimal. That is the minimal set that the government expects. The government expects our programs will be robust and address our organizational needs. Again, living, breathing, moving, active is what happens in a compliance program. There you go, Pam.
Thank you. Thank you, Paula. I just take a second to welcome everyone who just dialed in at 10:10 for the live call of Coffee with Decoder, episode 85. Thank you for telling your friends and sharing Coffee with Decoder with all of the people that are your peers. I do want to first, before I start throwing questions, I would like to ask for more questions. The question bank is thinning out a little, and I really, really don't have, I mean, I'm an IT person. I don't know all of the things that are interesting to you guys, so please send in more questions so that the team will have more things to research and we'll have more exciting things to discuss. We've got a webinar coming up on injections and infusions, and there's been some, it's been pretty stable, but that doesn't mean it's easy. And so we're going to delve into that topic in a few days. I don't have it yet, but it'll be on the website, so please check aq-iq.com regularly and keep up to date. Make sure you're getting our emails or something, some sort of communication, so that you'll know to participate in that. And would you like to say anything else, Paula, before I start handing you questions?
Nope, just send in questions. Hey, we're looking for more questions.
Okay.
Join the insiders. Yeah, too. Join the insiders.
Definitely. Yes, yes. And we do have a new group at LinkedIn, Coffee with Decoder Network, where there's additional fun things or participatory opportunities for those of you who would like to be insiders. Now, just for in case you're new, an insider is someone who you can get that title insider by more than one way. Okay, one of the methodologies is to dial in to the regular call 10 minutes early because we start at 10 o'clock for the pre-call, and many of you were there today, so that was our training on compliance. We get 10 minutes before the live call begins. Another way is to participate in our private Facebook group or our LinkedIn network. And you can get the replays of this portion of the call, which are not available to the people who are not in the insiders group. And we'd also like to have you share your mugshot, which is a picture of you and us, a selfie with us. And you can get us in the picture by anything you've received from us, whether you paid or didn't, like if you win one of our mugs today. Or you can write our name on a paper, have our website over your shoulder, whatever. It's just a picture of you and us together, a selfie, and we call that your mugshot. And now I'm ready to delve into this first question, and I believe it comes from a hospital setting. It's been sent in through the question box on aq-iq.com under the Ask tab, and this is from Abby. Abby says, when a diabetic patient is in observation, are you able to charge for the IMs of insulin they receive while they're in observation? They're not allowed to utilize their own medications. However, usually insulin is self-administered. Since they are admitted, our nurses are giving it. How do we address that?
Okay, excellent question. And thanks for your question. So actually, you know, we thought we knew the answer right off the top of our head, but, you know, as with many of the questions that are sent in, we wanted to research and give you some chapter and verse here. Now, some Medicare contractors speak specifically to the medication, but they don't really speak so clearly to the actual administration of that medication. So, yes, insulin is a self-administered drug. However, we did find Noridian and didn't look at every state, okay? So you need to go out and look at your own Medicare contractor and see if they publish something similar, which many times they do, or, you know, something to address the same issue. However, the Medicare Benefit Policy Manual does speak to it, okay? So Noridian, for example, states on their website, and this is verbatim, for certain injectable drugs, it will be apparent on its face, and that's in quotes, that the nature of the condition for which they are administered or the usual course of treatment for those conditions, chronic versus acute, in and of itself dictate the mode of usual administration. For example, a course of treatment consisting of scheduled injections lasting less than 2 weeks, regardless of frequency or route of administration, is considered by CMS as acute, and it would be unlikely that a patient would self-administer the drug in those circumstances. And here's where I want you to refer to. The Medicare manual system is PUB 100-02, Medicare Benefit Policy Manual, Chapter 15, 50.2. They go on to say, in the absence of objective data specific to the Medicare beneficiary population who are capable of self-administration of an injectable drug, this ABMAC, talking about Noridian, will consider the following factors listed, it says weighted on a per indication basis to estimate whether an injectable drug in the outpatient setting is usually or not usually self-administered. Okay, so what they go on to say is they look at the route of the administration, they look at the acuity of the condition being treated, the setting of the condition, or where is the patient, the setting, and the frequency of administration. Now, the fact that the patient is in observation and something is going on with that patient, there needs to be medical necessity documented for the administration of that insulin. And so in that situation, it may not be considered self-administered. So, again, you need to check with your state contractor, and that is, who the Medicare contractor is, to see if there's anything different out there. Check that reference that I gave you. But typically, the administration can be billed based on the acuity of the condition, the medical necessity for, the patient's diabetes and what's going on in that setting. So the answer is yes, but check with your payer because they may have something different to say. Okay?
Thank you, Paula. Oh, we're still in outpatient for this next question, and this one is from Anonymous. And those of you who are new, you may not know that anonymous questions are very welcome here. The only thing that is a potential change in your mind about whether to be anonymous is you're not in the running for today's mugging. So muggings are for people who are non-anonymously asking their questions, unless we happen to have all anonymous, in which case somebody who just dialed in will be the winner. But so this question is about colonoscopy. The person asks, is CPT code 45390 used when the physician states saline was injected to lift the polyp before removing with a snare?
Okay. Yeah, we just went right to the source on this one. According to CPT Assistant, January 2017, it states submucosal injection of substances, whether saline or epinephrine, to lift the polyp and facilitate a polypectomy is not, it's reported with 45381, which is colonoscopy flexible with directed submucosal injections in a substance. Now, the polypectomy would be reported with a second code, 45385, colonoscopy flexible with removal of tumors, polyps, or other lesions by snare technique, with a modifier 59 appended. The code, the 45390 that the questioner is asking about, is for EMR, so endoscopic mucosal resections with colonoscopy. That procedure has to include certain things. According to CPT Assistant, it requires, number one, the a performance of, number one, a submucosal injection to lift the lesion, which we're saying happened. Now, this is the important part because it needs to be documented or you're going to build those other two codes. Number two, it has to include demarcation of the lesion, often by creating a pseudopolyp out of tissue. So that has to be documented. If it isn't, you're billing those or you're reporting those other two codes. And then number three, endoscopic snare resection. So it's very similar to 45381 and 45385 reported together, but the identifying factor is that demarcation of the lesion has to be performed. If all three of those are not performed, then you're going to report the 45381 and 85. Okay?
Thank you. Okay, I think we have time for one really quick one. This is also anonymous from an inpatient rehab. There seems to be a lot of confusion on this particular point. Do the IRFPI and UB diagnosis codes have to match?
I am so glad that question got sent in, because we do inpatient rehab facility audits all the time, and sometimes I come behind other organizations who have done the audits, and they do, you know, maybe just a UB04 audit, and they're only looking at the coding on the UB04 rather than the coding on the IRFPI. Now, those two documents, I know we've talked about this before too, the two documents, the IRFPI and the UB04, follow two different sets of rules for assigning the diagnoses on those documents. They're similar, and they're the same in some situations as far as individual codes, but there are some situations, you know, such as stroke is the one I pull out. You know, on the UB04, you're reporting, you know, everything that is the sequela of the stroke, and then on the IRFPI, you're reporting everything that we like to call, it's not really the correct term, but we like to call the acute codes, so the symptom codes, if you will, I'll say, for those sequela, because it was an acute active condition. So there are different rules. Now, when we're doing audits, one of the first things I do for an inpatient rehab facility is I take that UB04 and I match it to the IRFPI. Now, not because they should match. They should not match in most occasions. I will say you rarely have a situation where everything is an exact match on the IRFPI and the UB04. But doing that match and highlighting the codes between the two documents, it tells you information about process, about what's going on in that organization, and you start to ask the question, well, is the coder, you know, what is the coder doing, and is the CMG or PPS coordinator getting the correct information from the coder, because there could be, you know, a lot of misunderstanding there. Now, typically, I'll find that there was an exact match between both documents, and I'm like, well, that's really not right, so let's check out where the problem is. And you continue to review charts, and you can start to see, wait a minute, this is a pattern. Let's talk about why this is happening. Is this an education issue or what? Or if they're too different and you're looking at that coder abstract as well, because, you know, many times the coder abstract can have way more diagnosis codes, specifically in inpatient rehab, than on the actual claim itself, there may be some information that is coded that is not on either document, because there are so many codes, and the folks putting them in their respective softwares didn't know, you know, which ones to choose. It's particularly, I'm talking about when the coder does the coding summary and sends that coding summary to the PPS coordinator, and the PPS coordinator has to determine which codes to put on the IRFPI. That works in many organizations, but in others it does not. So, again, that's one of those process things that if they're matching on both, we're going, wait a minute, ding, ding, ding. It's giving us a red flag to say, okay, what's the situation here? Is there something that needs to be addressed? Is there an education issue? Is there a process issue? So rarely you're going to match 100% the IRFPI and the UB04. And I'll say an example of this, and I feel like I need to say it, so I'm talking a little long-winded here. The etiologic diagnosis on the IRFPI is a different definition than the principal diagnosis on the UB04. So if it is a condition that, like, for example, a fracture, on the UB04, you're going to report typically, if it's a closed fracture, you're going to report that seventh character of D for your principal. And on the IRFPI, you're going to report the seventh character of A, because that was the acute condition that cause the need for rehab. And then there's several different, I guess, rules like that between those two documents. So very easily, you know, send in some more questions related to that if you don't understand, and hey, we'll be happy to address it. Pam?
Thank you, Paula, and thank you, everyone, for joining. And I just need to say that out of all three questions, one of them was non-anonymous. So, Abby, you win. I'm going to reach out to you and find out where to send your mug.
Yay.
Do send more questions. Yay, Abby. We look forward to visiting with you all either on Coffee with Dakota or a webinar or some other way. And in 2 weeks, on the next episode.